Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and welcome to our half-hour English feature program. I'm Susie Hodges. Coming up on today's program, Papal Audience. Pope Benedict devotes his catechesis to the figure of the 16th century Carmelite mystic, St. John of the Cross. Maghreb migrants. As Italy sounds the alarm following the arrival on its shores of over 5,000 mostly Tunisian migrants fleeing the turmoil in North Africa, we explore the issues at stake with the Jesuit refugee services. And marriage matters. February is when the Church celebrates Marriage Week to help reinforce the institution of marriage. And we look at a special programme that helps to rescue floundering couples whose marriage is heading for the rocks. At his weekly general audience, Pope Benedict looked at the figure of the 16th century Spanish Carmelite mystic, St. John of the Cross. Emma McCarthy reports.
Human effort is not enough to eradicate bad habits. It can only limit them. Instead, God's decisive intervention is needed, Pope Benedict XVI said Wednesday, dedicating his general audience to the figure of the 16th century Spanish saint and doctor of the Church, John of the Cross.
John was born into a poor family. As a young man, he entered the Carmelites and was ordained priest. Soon afterwards, he met Teresa of Avila in what was a decisive encounter for them both, as it is on plans for reforming the Carmelite order.
In comments in Italian, Pope Benedict asked whether this great saint and mystic has something to say to us today, or whether he is just a model for a chosen few. He said we must understand that John's life was a very hard and concrete one, even to the point of prison. Holiness, said Pope Benedict, is not only for a privileged few, but a path to which we are all called.
He became confessor of Teresa's monastery, and together they developed a rich articulation of the workings of the Lord upon the soul and the spiritual life. Despite persecution and misunderstanding from within his own order, John produced some of the most illuminating and insightful treatises in all of Western spirituality.
John of the Cross's four major writings are The Ascent of Mount Carmel, The Dark Night of the Soul, The Spiritual Canticle, and The Living Flame of Love. One of the themes much developed by John was that of the purification of the soul. By means of created things, we can discover traces of the living God in this world.
Faith, however, is the unique means by which we can come to know God as he is in himself. The demanding process of purification, at times active and at others passive, requires our determined effort, but it is God who is the real center. All man can do is dispose himself and humble himself before the loving work of God in the soul.
Pope Benedict concluded, John is for us a model of humble dedication and of faithful perseverance on the road to spiritual maturity. I'm Emma McCarthy.
Italy has warned that an influx of mostly Tunisian migrants arriving on its shores after fleeing the turmoil in North Africa could have devastating consequences for all European nations. Interior Minister Roberto Maroni says the migrants who have landed on the Italian island of Lampedusa threaten the institutional and social structures of Europe. Over 5,000 migrants, mostly from Tunisia, have arrived in Lampedusa in recent days after fleeing the turmoil in North Africa, following uprisings that led to the removal of the Tunisian and Egyptian presidents. Moroni has called the flow of migrants an exodus of biblical proportions that has never been seen before. Jane Stapleton is the International Communications Coordinator for the Jesuit Refugee Services, and I asked him whether he agreed with the minister's assessment and the use of such language to describe this exodus.
No, I think for the people living in Lampedusa, it's certainly a problem. It's a very, very small island, and the Italian government needs to provide all the assistance necessary to house the people on Lampedusa Island and ensure that those others are moved to accommodation on the mainland. But no, I think that the statements by the Italian authorities are unhelpful at this moment. A movement of 4,000, 5,000 people is certainly not a small amount of people, but for a country of 60 million people, it should be manageable.
Do people believe that many thousand more will continue to flee, though, given the ongoing turmoil in Tunisia, Egypt and other North African and Arab countries?
I think that the situation at the moment in North African countries is uncertain. The true answer is we really don't know what's going on. We find it very difficult to get information as to what's happening exactly in Tunisia. Having said that, there are European directives which cater for the situation of large movements of people. There's a directive granting temporary protection, and we would call on the European states to continue to monitor the situation, to accept the arrivals of people coming in at the moment and ensure that they have access to asylum procedures. What we're extremely concerned about is the statements where the Italian authorities are calling on Maghrebian states, North African states and other European states to prevent people from leaving. We're concerned that there may be people among the people who are leaving who are in need of protection, and arbitrarily stopping people from leaving could actually put some people's lives at risk.
Italy has in fact asked for EU help in trying to deal with this influx of migrants. Are you surprised by that, as you say, given the fact that it is not a huge amount of people, although they have come in quite a short period of time? I mean, what does JRS believe should be the response of Italy and the other European countries on whose shores the migrants may end up?
The first thing I'd like to say is I'm sure that the Italian authorities have information that we don't have. So maybe they have information as to larger numbers of people intending on leaving. So hold my judgment for that. What we would be calling on the European authorities to do is to monitor the situation closely, to ensure that those people who are leaving have access to protection within European waters. And if necessary, if the movement of people becomes bigger, then the directive on temporary protection needs to be applied.
Several dozen migrants have already drowned in the Mediterranean Sea during this exodus. I mean, is it likely we're going to see more deaths because they're travelling on such overcrowded and rickety boats?
Well, 14,000 people have died trying to get into Europe in the last 15, 20 years. It's just a continuation of that. Unfortunately, when people are fleeing, they can't choose the means in which they try to get out. And I think if the situation continues to be unstable in North Africa, then we're going to continue to see people dying.
How has the island of Lampedusa coped so far in this latest exodus? I mean, what are conditions like there for the migrants?
The conditions are difficult at the moment. I understand that the Italian authorities have now opened a reception centre on the island and that they're planning on moving people over. I mean, Lampedusa is an island with a population of a few thousand people. The arrival of 4,000 or 5,000 people is obviously going to put pressure on the situation. What we will be calling on European states, the Italian state first, but European states as well, considering this could get bigger, is to make plans to ensure that if there are larger movements of people, then the structures will be put in place to cater for them. And obviously there needs to be some form of contact with governments in North Africa to try and find a solution to what's happening. People talk about people leaving all of the time looking for better opportunities in Europe, but what we can actually see at the moment in Northern Africa is there's a great deal of instability and uncertainty about what the future holds. So it's obvious that people will try and take advantage of that to seek safety.
And what role is the local Catholic Church and maybe JRS playing in Lampedusa and these other areas? I heard that some of the churches were flinging open their doors. Do you know any more about that?
We haven't got a great deal of information. JRS had a project down there, but as you know, that Lampedusa closed. The staff in JRS Italy are now considering what their action should be over the next couple of months, because we don't feel that this is going to be a situation that's going to come and go within a number of days.
And what has been the reception like from the locals in Lampedusa, who've long been used to migrants landing on their shores en route from Africa?
I think there have been differing reports. We've read statements that some of the authorities have been welcoming and calling for, before Lampedusa Centre was opened, calling for the centre to be opened. I'm sure that the population is somewhat concerned. There's a lot of alarmist reporting in newspapers at the moment, talking about, as you said, the numbers arriving of biblical proportions. So people will be understandably concerned about that. I think it's up to the government to calm temperaments and ensure that the facility is available either in Lampedusa but also on the mainland.
But as you implied, this is an ongoing issue, isn't it? The flow of migrants from North Africa to Italy. And presumably it's not going to end as long as there's huge poverty and high unemployment in those Maghreb countries and relative prosperity over here in Italy.
Well, I think there are a number of issues. I think when we're talking about the people in the past, at least arriving through Lampedusa, 75% of them claimed asylum and half of those were granted some form of international protection. So we're actually talking about a particular type of person who was desperately fleeing human rights abuses in many cases, and if not in persecution. I think what's needed now, we can see that what's happening in the Mediterranean, the Dublin Convention, where all of the border states are responsible for the arrival of asylum seekers and the northern states are shirking their responsibility, particularly those further away from the borders. We need a concerted action now by European governments to ensure that this is not a problem of Italy, this is not a problem of Greece, this is not a problem of Spain or Portugal, this is a European issue. The Refugee Convention and international protection is based on the concept of responsibility sharing, and European states now, particularly in Europe now, need to get together and show that responsibility towards those people in need of international protection. But as you said, in the long term, there's also an issue of poverty and instability. And what happens is we need to also address that issue, because not only does poverty force people to flee, but it also creates instability and leads to conflict.
But on the part of the West, obviously, there needs to be solidarity, because this is a humanitarian issue, isn't it?
And at the moment, this is, as you said, a humanitarian issue. It's an issue to which we need to respond immediately, and then afterwards look more calmly towards what solutions can be found. At the moment, what's happening in Northern Africa, in Egypt, in Tunisia, has given people a lot of hope that the regimes in the future that will be installed will be more democratic, which will hopefully give more access to opportunity for their populations. At the moment, there's violence, there's instability, people are concerned, people are fleeing, and both Italy and European states have signed up to international agreements in which they provide protection to people fleeing from those circumstances.
I was speaking to James Stapleton, International Communications Coordinator for the Jesuit Refugee Services. The Catholic Church has been marking Marriage Week to celebrate the diversity and vibrancy of marriage as the basis for family life. Hannah Maruzzi is the Marriage and Family Life Communications Officer at the Catholic Bishops' Conference of England and Wales. She says despite the challenges of modern society, marriage remains incredibly popular, with over 90% of young Britons aspiring to be married at some point in the future.
It's very interesting, but when you talk to people, and certainly in the work that our coordinators are doing in the diocese, what comes across really strongly is that most people want to be married. You know, people want to have a firmly committed relationship with somebody else. And it might be society has changed to some degree, and it might be that people want to spend time together before they get married, and they might not do it in a sort of traditional way. But ultimately, at the end of the day, people want to be married, to be together, to share a life, to raise children. And I think that definitely comes across, perhaps not officially from the statistics, but definitely when you talk to people lying at the heart of the community, it's definitely what people want.
As I mean, Archbishop Vincent Nichols talking said it was a vital relationship within our society, and Pope Benedict has talked about, of course, the importance. Mm. He talks a lot, an awful lot about the importance of the family unit, the importance of marriage.
Absolutely. And I think that that's the key message here, is that it is the fundamental unit of society and the place in which human beings grow and develop and are nurtured and are educated and are taught how to be good human beings, people who can go out there and be valid members of society, who can communicate with other people, who can form relationships, who can make a difference.
That was Hannah Maruzzi, the Marriage and Family Life Communications Officer at the Catholic Bishops' Conference of England and Wales, talking to Lydia O'Kane. The flip side is that although the vast majority of people do tie the knot, 1 in 3 UK marriages end in divorce or separation. So what can be done to rescue a marriage that is heading for the rocks? Is divorce the only option? Find out more in this special report.
I just called to say I love you.
In the US, over 40% of marriages end in divorce. That's the depressing reality borne out by the statistics, and it's an indication of the daunting challenges many couples face in trying to keep their marriage afloat in today's secularized and high-pressured society. Successful marriages, however, don't work on autopilot, at least not for long. They need care and nurturing, and it's especially vital that the spouses keep the lines of communication open between the two of them. How many husbands or wives argue frequently or feel frustrated, hurt, or angry with their spouse? It's in situations like this that all too many couples believe that the only solution is to go down the path towards separation and divorce. But if married couples in crisis know where to look, help is at hand, and that help can often save a marriage. Originating in Canada, Retrovie is a program offered by Catholic couples and a priest to couples with marriage problems. Thousands of couples headed for cold, unloving relationships or divorce have successfully overcome their marital problems by attending a Retrovie program held in various countries throughout the world. Frank and Julie Laborda and Father Watt Bracken are American, and all three of them are volunteer international coordinators for Retrovie. Frank and Julie are married with 4 children and live in Madison, Wisconsin. They were pointed in the direction of Retrovie at a time when their own marriage was on the rocks and they were on the brink of divorce. They spoke to me about some of the reasons why their marriage was failing and how attending a Retrovie program helped to renew and heal it.
We had several problems, severe miscommunication and working opposite schedules.
So the communication issues led to us living quite separate lives. And as we worked different shifts in our work schedule, he was working days and I was working nights. And I began an affair with a woman I worked with and spent 9 months in an extramarital affair with a woman from work. Our marriage obviously went further downhill after that, and we were separated twice and 5 weeks away from our final divorce when we found Retrovie.
And how did you find it?
My mother-in-law, Julie's mother, gave her an article from a magazine in the States about the program, and I called right away and registered us for the weekend experience.
And, was it really quite dramatic, the turnaround?
It was extremely dramatic for me, but I still had a lot of fear and panic and trust issues. But it gave us hope, because the couples that presented the weekend, the couples on the team, had been through misery even worse than ours. And we thought, if they can make it, maybe there's some hope for us too. And it was very grace-filled. You could feel the presence of God. And the team priest was there as well. And we wondered what the priest would have to say about marriage. But it was very grace-filled, and I was overcome with the hope that they offered.
And were the majority of the people on this program Catholic? Because you say you're open to all religions or none, or those who have none.
Yes, I think on our weekend, a great majority of them were. But you're right that couples that come to Retrovie come with all different types of faith or no faith whatsoever.
Now, the program consists, I gather, of a weekend experience, and then this is followed up with 6 to 12 week post-weekend sessions over a period of 3 months. Did you already find after that first weekend that you were discovering where things were going wrong or where to pick up the pieces, or was it more of a question of learning to trust?
I think I knew where things were going wrong before, but I was always pointing a finger of blame at Frank. So the weekend helped me realize what role I played in the deterioration of our marriage. And then the follow-up sessions were integral in change because the post-sessions offered a chance to look more deeply at specific issues like trust, conflict, sex, forgiveness. And so that was really where the bulk of the change occurred throughout the post-sessions as well.
I think for me, the weekend showed me what could be right about our relationship again and reminded me of the reasons that I fell in love with Julie in the first place and why we were together from the start of our relationship rather than showing me what had been wrong, because you could see that in our behavior with one another on a daily basis. But being able to talk with Julie and communicate with her on a whole different level over the course of that weekend and then the post sessions really showed me what was right about our relationship again.
Is it a prerequisite that for people who go to Retrouvai that both couples want to save their marriage? Because presumably if somebody's already given up on it, then it's hopeless.
Well, in our case, Julie had given up. This was her way of checking this one last thing off of her list of things to do before the divorce was final. So no, I don't think that both couples have to be committed to saving their relationship. As long as they're committed to spending the time on the weekend together, it could change their relationship just by being there together.
Each couple is asked to participate fully in the entire weekend and the follow-up sessions. But we would be lying if everyone who came said, yes, I'm 100% committed to making this marriage work. But over the course of the weekend, most of them change their minds and decide, yes, this is worth saving.
Father Walt Bracken is a Catholic priest from Chicago. And along with Frank and Julie, he gave his viewpoint about the strengths of the Retrouvai program.
Before I go into what happens on the weekend, I think what is key, and Frank and Julie have already mentioned this, is the hope that is given on the weekend. The couples come there with a sense of hopelessness with regard to their own relationship. By listening to the stories of other couples, they recognize the fact that other people can go through difficulties as well and come out of those difficulties on the other side with a great deal of hope for their relationship. I think that is the beauty of a peer ministry. Peer ministry allows couples to tell their story of their misery, their story of their hopelessness, and how they moved to a sense of hope. And this is done simply on the weekend by 3 different couples and a priest giving a series of presentations. And the idea is that the couple gives a presentation with a priest. After that, the couples who are participating in the weekend are given a question to reflect. They do some writing, they come together, and then they share with regard to this. And through these series of presentations during the course of the weekend, couples are able to communicate with themselves much more deeply. What we tell the couples on a Friday night is we are not there to solve their problems or to work on their problems. What we do is work on their communication so that once they begin to relate to each other and to communicate to each other, then they begin to solve their own problems on how they choose to solve them.
Now, I don't know whether you keep statistics, but do you happen to know roughly what percentage of the couples who come to Retrouvai do manage to save their marriage? If you have any idea at all on how successful this program is?
We've seen somewhere in the neighborhood of 75 to 80% of marriages at least continue on. Successful marriages, probably half. But they stay in their relationship up to 80% of the time.
That's quite a high percentage.
It's a very high percentage. And it's an experience that we see over and over on the weekend from Friday night to Sunday.
I just call to say I love you.
But what real-life anecdotes do they have of couples attending the Retrouvai program whose marriage seemed doomed to collapse.
I can give you a story about a couple that we know. They were having difficulty. Of course, that's why they were on the weekend originally. They would do well after one presentation in their dialogue, and then they'd go back after another presentation, and they would find themselves arguing again. So on Saturday night, after the first presentation, they seemed to be doing well. After the second presentation, they started an argument, and they figured that it was no use. So they packed their bags, and they decided to leave the retreat house. Well, as happened, as they were driving out of the retreat grounds, there was a chain across the gate of the retreat house. And so there was no way that they could leave the grounds. So they turned around, they unpacked their bags, brought them back in to the retreat house. And long story short, I think this is God's sense of humor by having that chain across the gate, because this couple then continued to work on their relationship, not only on that weekend, but they themselves became very involved with Retrovi after this, to the point where they have given a good number of weekends themselves and a good number of presentations to help heal other marriages.
Do you know of any other particular anecdotes that stick in your mind?
Several, including us, but another couple that when we were presenting team on a weekend, this couple too was up and down and finally got in a huge argument and decided to drive home, and they had about an hour drive. They got about 10 minutes from home and decided it would be harder to tell their kids that they gave up than it would be to turn around with their heads hanging and walk back in the door of Retrovi. So they turned their car around and they came back and finished the weekend and completed all of the follow-up sessions.
And as far as you know, they're still
together?
And
as far as we know, they're still together and doing well.
Now, coming back, perhaps, shall we say, to the general state of marriage in society today, as you all know, particularly in Western countries, the rate of divorce is incredibly high. Why is that? Why do people give up so quickly, do you think? What more could the church and other bodies be doing to try to bring down that rate of divorce, of separation between couples?
It has a lot to do with the family. John Paul the Great was right when he said, as the family goes, so goes the world. And so Retrovi in the church, I think, is certainly moving in the right direction to curb the divorce rate.
I just think it's so hard, especially in Western countries. We're so bent on instant gratification. And if it's not what I want, I'm going to take it back or return it because it doesn't fit right. And that's carried right over into our relationships. It's not making me happy, so I'm going to return it and start over. And it's greener grass on the other side of the fence. And in most cases, in mine for sure, you know, in being involved in a 9-month relationship with another woman, it's no different. The problems are the same. You carry the problems with you wherever you go. So you can choose to stay in the relationship you started with and fight for your marriage and work on change in your own personal life and in your relationship, or you can continue to throw them away and start with a new one. And especially in the United States, we're at the point where our society says it's just easier to toss it aside.
That was Frank Laboda, and you also heard the voice of his wife, Julie, and of Father Watt Bracken, speaking about the marriage rescue program called Retrovi.
I love you, and I mean it from the bottom of my heart.
Well, that's all for today from me, Susie Hodges, here at Vatican Radio's English programme. But we hope you have enjoyed listening to us. We'll be on the air again at the same time tomorrow. And don't forget, you can always find our programmes at the click of a mouse on the internet at www.vaticanradio.org. Laudato Jesus Christus.